Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing you the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
John Heder and Allison Stoner lend their voices to Huevos, Little Rooster's Excellent Adventure, an animated feature about a rooster who must fight to save his home after it's threatened by an evil rancher. It's now playing on demand. Also playing on demand is Amy, a deeply moving documentary about the Grammy-winning artist Amy Winehouse, her incredible talent, and her tragic demise.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The art house is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And this is the 100th episode of Film Spotting SVU. And you know something, Udovich? This might just be our masterpiece. And that's because we're going to review Quentin Tarantino's war film, Inglourious Basterds.
Would you please stop calling me Udovich?
No.
Fine. No cue shots on this episode because, with December upon us, it is once again time for the Svoovy Awards, where we look back on the year that was in movies and give our signature strange awards on everything from the films we loved and everyone else hated, the movies we hated that everyone else loved, and lots, lots more, including a few categories suggested by the real heroes, you, the Film Spotting SVU listeners. But first up, it's opening break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand. And Allison, it is your turn to lead the discussion. What are our picks this time?
Well, I've got three really interesting films, and they are all available now on demand. The first up is Breathe. This is the second film as a director from Melanie Laurent, who is the star of this week's Listener's Choice Review, Inglourious Basterds, as well as more recently Angelina Jolie's fascinating mess of a movie, By the Sea. This movie stars Josephine Jappy as Charlie, who is a high school girl in a French suburb who befriends the new girl in school, Sarah, played by Lou Delage. And Sarah is sophisticated and bold. She tells stories about living in Nigeria with her mother, who she says is working at an NGO. And the two girls have this kind of all-consuming friendship for a while, which then takes a turn into bullying when things go sour.
C'est bien devant, regarde les phares, allez!
La meuf, elle appelle le cas, lui dit juste bonjour, le mec, il est déjà chez elle.
Movies that have been made about female friendships that turn toxic, especially around this age in your life before. And it's a subject I think is still underexplored and that I really like. The fact that when you're young, that you can have these friendships that are in some ways like as emotionally involved as romances and that can cause you as much emotional pain. And this is a really smartly observed film about teenage cruelty and teenage closeness. I think it loses a thread a bit at the end, but it's a very smart film. And as often is the case with films that are directed by actors, it gets two great performances from its leads and really like lets them shine. So it's a nice little film, Breathe, from Melanie Laurent. That's now available on demand, as is Goodnight Mommy. This is a horror film of sorts, written and directed by Severin Fiala and Veronica Franz. And it stars Lucas and Elias Schwartz as Lucas and Elias, twin boys living in a country house in Austria with their mother, who's recovering from a surgery that has left her face ominously in bandages.
Uh-oh.
And the two boys, who kind of spend all of their time in the days mostly alone, kind of entertaining themselves out playing in the wild or hanging around in the house, begin to suspect that their mother is actually not their mother, that beneath those bandages there is someone else, and that there's an imposter who's tricking them. And, you know, I think there was a kind of push for this to be one of the other kind of great horror films of the year, along with It Follows, on the kind of like arty horror scale. Mm-hmm. I don't think this is as good as It Follows. I think its kind of plot might not be as surprising as I think it would like it to be, but it is a beautifully made movie. It is stunningly shot, and there are so many shots that are just spooky. And if you find little blonde twins spooky, well, they're pretty spooky as main characters as well. It's a really well-made film that I think can get a lot more creepiness than other people would be able to out of like two children basically hanging out in a house.
Would it at least make a good double feature with Phoenix for movies with people wearing bandages on their face?
Probably not.
Oh.
But I would say they're both worth watching.
Okay.
Especially
separate,
since I think
but
Phoenix,
separately.
Phoenix is fantastic. And
yes.
it's a pretty solid film,
okay,
all in all. So that is Good Night, Mommy. And lastly is a film I have not seen yet, but I'm excited to see, because it is the film continuation of the British series Spooks, which here was called MI5, which is the name of the film as well. I watched a few seasons of Spooks and really enjoyed it. Most of it seems to be available for rent online, but not streaming as far as I could find. It's, you know, a contemporary show about spies. In the UK, I think particularly interesting for how it cycled through its cast. Characters, main characters would get killed off or kind of shunted off, forced to quit. It over its 10 seasons, it ended in 2011. It went through, season one started with Matthew McFadden and David Oyelowo. And then from there, it went to like Rupert Penry-Jones and Richard Armitage and Laura Pulver.
I've seen a little of the show. I didn't realize it lasted so long.
Yeah.
10 seasons.
And I think there was only one cast member, I think, that has been in every season.
Mm-hmm.
This movie.
The screech of the group, so to speak.
Yes. It's more the principal of the group, I think.
Belding.
Yes. But this movie brings in as new characters Kit Harington of Game of Thrones,
right,
and Jennifer Eale, who is awesome.
Yep.
And tells another probably emotionally and ethically devastating story about the cost of spying.
I just like the poster for that movie because it looks just like a Mission Impossible movie.
Exactly.
They're really turning into the whole MI Mission Impossible thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I admire the gall and the cojones to do that, frankly.
If you watched any of the series, this will probably be of interest to you. And if not, I don't think you really need to be up on the series to kind of follow what seems to be the storyline. Basically know that it's about both like the tense thrills of being a spy and also usually the terrible costs. So that is MI5, and that is also now available on demand.
Do you control the nicknames your enemies bestow on you? Aldo the Apache and the Little Man?
What do you mean, the little man?
German's nickname for you.
The German's nickname for me is the little man?
And as if to make my point, I'm a little surprised how tall you were in real life. I mean, you're a little fellow, but not circus midget little, as your reputation would suggest.
Where's my man? Where's Bridget von Hammersmark?
Well, let's just say she got what she deserved. And when you purchase friends like Bridget von Hammersmark, you get what you pay for.
All right, ramblers, let's get rambling. On episode 99 of Film Spotting SVU, we let you guys decide what Quentin Tarantino movie we would review on SVU 100. Your options were Tarantino's debut film, Reservoir Dogs, his two-part martial arts spectacular, Kill Bill, or his revisionist war movie, Inglourious Basterds. Listeners weren't particularly jazzed about the thought of revisiting Reservoir Dogs, which lagged well behind the other two contenders, but they were pretty evenly split on those other options. But in the end, Inglourious Basterds prevailed by a small handful of votes. Democracy wins in the film as well, but it's not always pretty. The title characters here are a band of Jewish American soldiers led by the part Apache Lieutenant Aldo Raine, played by Brad Pitt. The Bastards' mission is one of intimidation and terror. They sneak around behind enemy lines in World War II, causing trouble, creating chaos, and building a legend for the Germans to be afraid of. And in a move Lieutenant Raine claims is inspired by his Native American ancestors, they scalp each of their victims. And these are the good guys, Allison. The bad guy, meanwhile, has much better manners. He's Colonel Hans Landa of the SS, nicknamed the Jew Hunter for his predilection for tracking down those that have ran away or gone into hiding. But as played by Christoph Waltz, who won an Oscar for the role, he always does it with a big smile on his face and only the most polite conversations. I think if what he did and everything he stood for wasn't completely despicable, you might even describe him as admirably good at his job. And then there is Shoshana, played by the aforementioned already Melanie Laurent, who narrowly escapes Landa's brigade and becomes the proprietor of a cinema in Paris. And when a German war hero convinces the high command of the Nazis to premiere a propaganda film about his life at Shoshana's theater, all of these different groups of characters converge, along with Adolf Hitler himself, to take in a movie whose violence quite literally spills off the screen. Allison, we have been doing this podcast for a very long time now, 100 episodes, and we did over 200 episodes of another podcast before that. So I know already that when Inglourious Basterds came out back in 2009, I know we were both really looking forward to it, and we were both kind of disappointed by it. So now that you've had another look at it, what do you think? Do you find more to appreciate this time, or do you still find it to be one of Quentin Tarantino's weaker efforts?
I liked it more and less at the same time.
Oh, an interesting response.
Yeah, I think that I appreciated the concept more of in ways like writing or rewriting history through cinema.
Yes.
You know, I appreciated the kind of cleverness and the pandering of that. I appreciated the ways in which characters are all so many characters are involved or come from the film world in this war, this war in action film.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated a bit more some of the, especially in the first half of the film, some of the scenes that build up tension slowly. I mean, this movie is entirely made of those scenes, really.
Yes.
And I think towards the end, I am still exasperated by them. I think there is a scene with Landa at the end involving like the radio and all of that, where
the phone,
yes,
yeah,
just like tapping my fingers, and I'm like, "This is your exciting conclusion." But I appreciated that. The thing that I think I like even less about it now is, and it's something that I've been thinking about over the last three Quentin Tarantino movies, including The Hateful Eight, which I think we have both seen now.
Nope.
Oh, you have not seen it yet?
Yes, okay. I'm seeing it this week.
Which I have seen, and I think that, and which I enjoyed with some reservations.
Okay.
But I think that I have to think about the fact that Tarantino has this real sadistic streak. I don't think anyone would argue that. He enjoys, it's not violence necessarily that is the issue, and I think both of us watch films that are violent all the
time. Sure.
It is the ways in which it kind of licks its lips over some of these scenes. I think like his films can lean into that in a way that can sometimes feel off-putting. And I think that I still have trouble with and struggle with the ways in which these last three films have kind of incorporated historical atrocity and racism as a way to kind of make that sadistic streak righteous.
Mm-hmm.
And I just still don't really buy that with this.
Yeah.
You know, I don't buy it as this like multiple Jewish character revenge story that like the carnage of which is very high and the kind of meanness behind it is
right.
very high.
Right.
Well, how about you?
I think we're pretty much on the same page generally. We might differ over certain specifics, but yeah, I mean, I haven't been a huge fan of this movie. When it first came out, I liked it, okay. And rewatching it, I mean, as it started, I was really into sort of the precision of it. The opening scene is terrific and rightfully regarded as sort of a great set piece unto itself. But then as it goes on, I did kind of feel like it's a lot of like set pieces unto itself. You know, it's divided into chapters, which a lot of his movies are. You know, it's not like he suddenly started making narratively quirky movies with Inglourious Basterds. But for some reason here, it does a little go off the rails for me. It feels disjointed in a way that a movie like Pulp Fiction does not, even as it's jumping around. That movie just, I don't know, there's something about it that it feels more propulsive. And as I'm watching it this time, I'm just like, yes, some of the scenes are great, and then some of them just seem to go on forever. Even some of the ones that are fairly tense, like the scene in the basement.
The basement, that's,
which
yes.
Some people love. Some people think that's a masterpiece.
But it's got so much, like, fat on it.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, there's a lot of fat in this movie. There are scenes like that beginning, and there are other moments where the precision that Tarantino is sort of showcasing is incredible. And every shot, every beat, every glance, they all feel so specific and brilliant, frankly. And then there are other times where it just feels like he's always an indulgent filmmaker. Like, that's
needn't be said.
Right.
Yeah.
But it just feels like at a certain point it's become less like indulgent for the audience's pleasure and more indulgent for his pleasure mostly or first. And I just, I watch this movie and there are moments, lots of moments where I go, I don't really feel like this is in here for anyone but Quentin Tarantino's pleasure. And I'm certainly not getting a lot of pleasure out of it. And the stuff you're talking about in terms of the violence and the sort of, I hadn't really thought about it this way, but the way you put it, the way he's sort of taking racism, you know, these horrible events of true history and using them almost as an excuse to justify, you know, this wildly sadistic violence. I don't know if I would say it's right or wrong, but it doesn't really do it for me the way it seems to do it for him. You know what I mean? Like you said, we enjoy action movies and violence in movies. I'm not opposed to any of that. But I don't know, the way that this movie luxuriates in it is, it's troubling at times. And the weird thing is, I don't really know. It's not even that it's troubling. It's that I don't really know how I'm supposed to feel about this. It goes back and forth. It's just so muddled. Like, there's the scene in, and I think we should just, this movie is 6 years old.
We're going to spoil it.
Yeah, spoilers are completely off here. We could say whatever we want. If you haven't seen it, go watch it on Netflix right now. The scene, like, for example, there's that kind of beautiful, sad scene where Shoshana dies in the projection room. It's, yeah, like, brutal. And then literally the next scene is Eli Roth and the other one of the bastards putting on these hand guns.
They like, gun punch people.
Yeah, and they're doing these, like, comic booky kind of slow-mo-y, Matrix-y almost moment where they're gun punching people. And I'm just like, how did we go from this sad, tender scene that's like almost beautiful
from your character who has the most storied, like terrible past,
right,
you know, who is like supposedly the heart of your movie,
right, to, all right, we're gonna get these two guys that are standing outside this opera box in the quote-unquote coolest way we could possibly do it? It's just like, I don't know, it feels like a contradiction to me. I don't see how they fit together
in the same way where I had forgotten that you see Diane Kruger's character die, and die horribly.
Yes.
Like, she gets strangled to death.
Yes.
And in a scene that feels, like, largely unnecessary, really.
Not
like,
only unnecessary, it doesn't, I don't think, looking at it again, that it makes any sense, given what Hans Landa does in his next scene, which is, like, surrender,
right,
try to convince, like that, you mentioned that scene is really bad, and it is. Everything about it, I think, stinks. But particularly, what is this character doing? He seems the whole movie like he's a true believer, and I guess that's supposed to be the fun of it, is the reversal. But why did he just brutally, sadistically murder? I guess he's an opportunist, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. And this is something that has always exasperated me about this movie. There is no need for the bastards. Like, they are extraneous.
True.
They're
true.
Like, that whole setup, the whole Operation Kino doesn't matter.
No.
You know, like those, like Eli Roth, the gun punching people, doesn't,
right,
matter. All of those people die because Shoshana's plan, her own personal revenge plan,
right,
works out. They would all get burnt up in the theater.
Right. Their dynamite, I guess, does go off at the end of the movie, but arguably is
the
completely unnecessary.
The theater is on fire,
right,
and the doors are locked.
And they're shooting at these Nazis like fish in a barrel. That really doesn't matter at all. And I definitely think that's certainly purposeful on Tarantino's point, but again, to what end and what successful
right, when you devote
comes from that,
so
yeah,
much of the movie to this, it's all sound and fury.
But do they really spend that much of the movie with
them?
They
don't spend that much movie on anyone. I feel like when I first saw this movie, I felt it was, I didn't like it because it felt like every scene introduced a new character and then the movie ended.
Their movie ended, you mean?
No, the movie
The whole
general,
movie ended.
Right? Like,
okay,
almost every scene. Like, here is Shoshana, and then here are the Inglourious Basterds.
Right.
And
here's the film
Archie,
critic,
the film critic,
yes,
slash spy. Here's Bridget von, you know,
Hammersmark.
Bridget von Hammersmark, the actress slash spy.
Sure.
And then, like, by then, you're at, you know, you're
the end of
you're
the
at
movie.
The end of the movie.
Yes.
And it does feel like it. There's no middle, like, or all of those connecting scenes are very deliberately left off. You know, you see Arlo Rain, you see Aldo Rain introducing the idea of the bastards, and then immediately cut to them as legends already.
Yes.
You know, like, all of the movie is about kind of skipping to the end, introducing, and then skipping to the end of the story.
It does, like I said, it feels like a bunch of short films. It really does. Or, and this is something I was thinking about this time, because, you know, obviously, I haven't seen Hateful Eight yet, but the big push about this movie is the film, that he shot it in 70mm. They're showing it in 70mm with a road show, with an intermission. This is film, film, film. He is, you know, proselytizing for old-fashioned cinema and old-fashioned celluloid film. And I haven't seen that movie yet, so you could maybe talk a little bit about it, although I know you're still kind of under an embargo. But whatever. But this movie in particular, it kind of feels like he wants to move into television to me. This Inglourious Basterds would be such a great TV show.
I agree.
And you know, I know in interviews he's talking about wanting to make a TV show, but it's just so interesting to me that Tarantino, who is so much obsessed with film, 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 that he basically bought his own Revival House Cinema in Los Angeles so that he had a place to show his movies in 35mm, a place that only shows. You cannot show digital at this theater. They only show film prints, which is fabulous, wonderful, great. And yet I watch this movie and I go, this is kind of a guy whose tastes and talents at this point in his career might be just as suited or maybe more suited to television than the art of film.
I would agree. I think, you know, I feel less that way about Hateful Eight, which is very deliberately confined to one, you know, one area and like one showdown, basically. But this movie, yeah,
it feels like a TV show.
It feels like
in some ways.
Huge portions of it that could be expanded.
Absolutely,
yeah,
could be a great like 13-episode series with all of these characters getting, like you're saying, instead of just introducing them and then sort of shoving them to the finale, having them be built up a little bit. I agree, and you know, like the character I loved this time around is Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt's great in this movie, and he doesn't get that much screen time. I mean, I know he's like the top-billed star, but he has almost all of the best moments in the movie, and he's not in it that much.
I know. The scene in which he and Eli Roth and the other guy
pretend to be Italian. And that scene is amazing.
Yeah, and Christoph Waltz is like knows exactly, like they're so faking it.
Yes.
He's like, make it sing, say it again. It's so funny. Like, it's just so.
Alberto Margheriti. Eli Roth is good in that
scene
too.
He's good too. Yeah, I know. And little bits like that, like moments like that are what I love about Quentin Tarantino as much as him, like, using the searcher shot, you know, at the end of that first sequence. Like he's good at grandiosity, but also he's just good at, like, little funny moments, like, wry moments like that.
Yeah.
And I want more of those than I do these, like, 45-minute dialogue set pieces, you know, in which tension grows and grows and grows and grows.
It is interesting that he has this reputation, rightfully so, as a filmmaker of violent movies with, you know, action and these sorts of things, and yet his movies are so talky, and this one might be his most talky film. It is just, as you said, a series of dialogue scenes, a series of negotiations, a series of scenes, and some of them work better than others, where characters are feeling each other out, you know, saying their one thing but actually being another, and trying to hide their true identities, whether they're a spy, whether they're a Jewish woman in France pretending to be someone else because there's Nazis are everywhere. I think, like, thematically on that level, it works really well. I don't know. It does feel a little redundant and a little just diffuse, and it doesn't feel tight. Some of those scenes that just go on and on and on that you just, you know, it's a 2.5-hour movie that... It's like at that length, it's both too long and too short. You know, it's too long to be a really kind of tight-knit, great sort of punch in the gut, and it's too short to give you the full experience of the Bastards and Londa and Shoshana and give them all of their storylines because they really don't feel like people. I mean, the Bastards, you know, even beyond Aldo and the Eli Roth character who gets a little bit of a thing because he's like the guy who beats people to death with baseball bats. There's just, you don't even know their names. I guess Hugo Stiglitz also has sort of a memorable moment.
Udovich.
And Udovich just because of that great line. But that's it. There's like 5 or 6 other bastards, right? And we don't even know their names. And it's like...
I know. And it's given that this movie is so much about introducing people as like these like larger giant than characters. Life figures. And yeah, so mythic. Many of them are like, I mean, like Michael Fassbender doing that accent, you know, doing like the plummiest of British accents.
Yeah. Like, he's fun too, though.
He's so much fun. Yeah. And Diane Kruger is like delightful in this.
Right.
You know, I like so many of these characters are so much fun. And then you wish, yeah, like you wish you actually had an interval to spend with them that did not involve, for some of these characters, did not involve them showing up and then dying
immediately.
Yeah.
Yes. Certainly something I felt this time. I will say one thing that I did appreciate more about this film this time around, and it's something you could only appreciate in hindsight, was sort of how many actors who you didn't know at the time or sort of vaguely familiar with that were on the way up that, you know, Tarantino's big thing that he's so famous for is finding actors who've been neglected, right? That have sort of on the back end of their career, he revitalizes them. He finds these roles that make us remember why we love these people in the first place. And in this case, it's sort of the opposite because it's him finding these people who aren't that famous, who have gone on to have really good careers, you know, like Melanie Laurent and Christoph Waltz. And I mean, Léa Seydoux, I didn't even know she was in the movie. And then there she is in that first scene. And even Michael Fassbender was certainly not that big of a star when he was in this. There's a lot of those kind of those performances where you go, I didn't even realize that this person was in the movie when I saw it the first time. And now it means a lot more. Daniel Brühl is another one who's good in the movie. I appreciated that a lot this time that I definitely didn't appreciate because I couldn't appreciate it in 2009.
Yeah, I agree. And it's got a great cast. And even like I enjoyed Mike Myers in that scene. I enjoyed a lot of I think that there are a lot of great performances in this. And you just...
Not enough room for him.
They had room to breathe.
Yeah.
And I also, like, I had forgotten, by the way, about the finale, that the characters are sent in as, like, suicide bombers.
Yes.
And I feel like all of that, like a lot of this movie, I don't understand. It doesn't seem to make sense to me unless you've accepted that in creating these characters that they are disposable. Like, I mean, I feel like, you know, that main complaint about being like, this is filled with colorful characters who are immediately sent to die.
Right.
Why are they sent as suicide bombers?
Well, I think maybe it's just designed to be a subversive element because we are rooting essentially for suicide bombers.
Sure, I understand that. But I mean, if you're going to treat these people as characters in any way...
I think that's fair. I think that's very fair. To me, the ending is just about Tarantino making an ending where he can literally, like, win World War II with the power of cinema.
Sure.
So it's not even, like, the narrative essentially is sort of taking a huge backseat to the point he wants to make, which is about, in this case, the literal fiery, explosive power of movie making, which is sort of a lovely point to make, I guess, except he's making it in the most unlovely way possible.
I mean, I think, like, that shot, like, when the theater's on fire and her face in the film goes on the smoke.
Something very interesting about that shot to me. I mean, I don't know what it is.
I think it's a fantastic and terrifying shot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I there's something about the ways in which all of these characters go so easily. And I mean, it's something that crops up in certain other recent Tarantino movies too. But like that... there's like an assumed disposability about them.
Right.
That just seems weird to me. Almost as if they know that they're in a Tarantino movie and that their lives are kind of like meaningless.
Yeah. That's interesting. And certainly that is not the way it felt in early Tarantino movies. The end of Reservoir Dogs, the end of Pulp Fiction, or I guess technically not the end. It's like the middle of Pulp Fiction.
Right,
when a character we really care about dies,
right,
that meant a lot.
Right.
You felt it.
Yeah.
And you're right. In this movie.
And Bruce Willis in that movie in Pulp Fiction wants to live and is not. And I feel like if he made that movie now, Bruce Willis would die. You know,
I think you're probably right. I think most of the characters would die.
I know.
He really does seem to delight in killing off just about all
everyone,
of his characters.
Bad, like the bad guys, quote unquote, the good guys. Like, yeah,
that's true. I think it's an interesting point that you bring up there that I hadn't also considered that sort of not just the violence, which has always been there, but just again, like the callousness of it where, yeah, you know, that he seems to like create these people just to kill them.
Yeah.
That they can't, they have no actual life. It's just birth and death. There's no in between, which is, I don't know, even like it just, maybe it is by design because he wants them to be disposable because that's what he's doing. But it's just like, doesn't it mean a lot more and it makes more of an impact when you feel like these characters have more of an actual existence.
That they want to live.
Right. Or we've seen them struggle to achieve things. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think this is going to be a popular review of ours, Allison. I'm curious to see. We might get some some feedback from the listeners, which I'm fine with.
I'd love to hear some passionate defenses. Yeah, you know, I think we've spent 6 years with this movie.
Yep.
So, yes, please let us know at SVU, at filmspottingsvu.com. We want to hear your either vigorous defenses of Inglourious Basterds or telling us we're so right and we've been right all along.
Mm.
Especially that. We always like to hear that.
So that's Inglourious Basterds, and that is currently available on Netflix.
Welcome back to the 18th annual Spoovy Awards.
Yay, it's the Spoovy Awards.
Ah.
Thank you. I'll add some sound effects there. No, I won't. I'm definitely not going to do that. The Spoovy Awards. This is something we've been doing actually since the old podcast, which for some reason we called them the Spoovy Awards even then.
We could see into the future.
Right.
Well, they stood for something else back then, but I don't really remember.
But the categories change from year to year. Some of them stay the same, but we like to mix them up. But basically, yeah, we've been doing this for a long time now where everyone does, you know, the best films, the best actor, the best actress, blah, 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 blah. And it's just like, do you really need another podcast like that? No, a lot of people do that, and they do a really great job with it. So we like to do just different stuff. And so there's some categories here that we do every year, including the first two, which we'll get to in 1 second. And then there's some that we do that are either we think of each year, depending on what movies have come out, what we want to talk about. And also we have a few that are suggested by listeners. And we will try to thank the listeners who wrote in and suggested them when we get to those. But we start, as I think we usually do, with the two awards that we definitely do every single year. There's actually three we do. The third one we do last.
Okay.
So the first two that we always do are the We Didn't Get It Award and the They Didn't Get It Award. It's very self-explanatory. The We Didn't Get It Award is a film that was critically acclaimed, perhaps a blockbuster, a big success that we did not like. And then the They Didn't Get It Award is a movie that we loved that perhaps was not a success, either critically or commercially or whatever it is. We start this year with the We Didn't Get It Award. Allison?
Yes.
What didn't we get?
I did not get Brooklyn. Which is
provocative.
Yes, is currently in theaters and looking to be an awards contender.
Yes.
Certainly for Saoirse Ronan, who is the star. This is John Crowley's film about an Irish girl named Ailis who emigrates to Brooklyn from Ireland in the 1950s, feels homesick and miserable for a while, and then finds a job, finds some friends, and starts a romance with an Italian-American plumber named Tony, played by Emery Cohen. And I just felt like this movie was beautiful and lacking dramatic stakes. I just felt like, you know, the choice that she has to face between going, like, she goes back to Ireland for a little bit and she has to decide if she wants to stay and this life that seems to have suddenly opened up for her, or to go back to Brooklyn. And I just felt like such a strange way to tell an immigrant story. Like, pretty good where you came from and it's pretty good where you've gone. Which one will you pick? And I don't know. I mean, I just never... Well, there are huge choices here being made about like where you're going to start your new life and how that brings you away from all of the people that you used to know, including your family. I didn't feel like it really mattered. It just felt like it pretty and nice.
I don't disagree with anything you're saying. And yet I liked it. I enjoyed
it.
It's a nice movie.
Yeah.
I agree. There's not a lot to it. I think what it is just a extremely well-made little movie. I watched it the night of Thanksgiving with my wife and my in-laws, and we all sat there, and it was a movie we could all just sit together and enjoy.
It is definitely a movie that you can watch with your parents. If you have to go, like, it's the holidays and you have family and you're going to go out to see a movie, this one is a totally innocuous movie to see with
your
family.
Think Saoirse Ronan gives a lovely performance, and I liked... You know, it's just like, it's a movie that you like spending time with. Sort of like what we've been saying about Inglourious Basterds. We like these characters. We want to spend time with them. That was how I felt about this movie. I agree that the section in Ireland is not very strong. That's really the part where it needs to, the stakes, everything you're saying, I kind of agree with. But I have to say, I saw the things you're saying, and I was just like, I don't really care. I'm really enjoying it.
I appreciate that. And I will say this, as someone who is a first-generation immigrant and who is a child of immigrants, I think I just found something kind of personally disappointing about the story, because for so many other people, like, the opportunity to immigrate to America for more opportunities is a big deal. And yeah, involves, like, my parents both left their families behind and everything they knew behind. And that's certainly difficult. I don't like seeing it being made into such a kind of weirdly even-keeled choice. I think I personally resented that. But that is just me. How about you, Matt? What didn't you get this year?
My We Didn't Get It award goes to a movie I truly didn't get, but a lot of other people did. I think if we go by admissions, tickets admissions, more people got this movie than any other movie in 2015, because it's the biggest hit of 2015, and that's Jurassic World. Allison, would you like to guess, or maybe you know, how much money Jurassic World made worldwide?
It's over $1 billion.
It is indeed.
I'm going to guess $1.2 billion.
Oh, you're way off. It's $1.6 billion. Dollars. Yes, $1.6 billion. And, you know, like, on a certain level, like in a theoretical sense, I do get it. We all love Jurassic Park and
dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs. And this movie was very cleverly positioned as the Jurassic Park sequel we've always wanted, where you have a functioning Jurassic Park with lots of cool dinosaur attractions, which leads to lots of, you know, dinosaurs busting out and eating people. And on that level, the movie was fine. I thought the design of Jurassic Park in the movie was kind of cool. The effects were cool, great, happy. But anything involving the human characters in this movie, I just thought was so stupid, it borderline offended me. Like, I was almost offended by how dumb these people were, and by proxy, how dumb the movie was. And I even did a piece on Screen Crush at the time where I ranked every character in the movie from dumbest to least dumb, and the number one ranking, and no one disagreed with me, was the Indominus Rex, was the dinosaur. All of the people in the movie are dumber than the dinosaur serial killer in the movie. She's literally the most intelligent creature on that island. And in some cases, she's like the most intelligent creature by like a factor of 10. You know, you got like the CEO. He inherited Jurassic Park. He built the place. And in one scene, he's the idealistic dreamer who just wants to build beautiful things. And in the next scene, he's like, why don't I have my death dinosaur? Why isn't it built? Put it. I don't care if it's dangerous. Put it out. Let the people see it.
Yeah, like Bryce Dallas Howard is responsible for like many deaths, and it's never a problem.
No.
Like, she gets to get the guy at the end.
Absolutely. There's also her nephews who
are terrible people and so deserve to be eaten.
So punchable. Ugh. So incredibly punchable. They're in that gyrosphere. And then like,
they just go off by themselves.
They go off by themselves, Allison. They go in through a hole in the fence that's not only marked danger warning, it has a clear hole that's been ripped through it by a dinosaur.
It's a self-loathing documentary a bit. Like, there's a streak of, like, awareness that all of these things are the case. I don't know. The best part of that movie for me was the scene in which the teenager is, like, on his phone not paying attention to the T-Rex that you don't see. I mean, that's really smart. Yeah. But I feel it, like, feeds the whole movie, which is that, like, it's like, don't you want bigger? Don't you want more? Isn't this what you want?
Yeah.
And I don't. And it's in a way that's almost like, I know this isn't the best way to make a movie, but like,
there
this
is
what you want. And it worked.
Like I said, I get people wanting a new Jurassic Park. I just don't get that it was this successful. This successful means people were going multiple times. They were telling people they know, go see Jurassic World. I just don't get it. You know, were people that hungry for a new Jurassic World that they would take literally anything? They can do better, and they should do better. So that's my We Didn't Get It award, Jurassic World.
All right. Well, next up is the They Didn't Get It award, the award in which we wild-eyed defend a movie that no one else liked. Yes. Matt, what is your pick for this award?
Well, on the complete other end of the spectrum from Jurassic World is one of the biggest flops of the year. My They Didn't Get It award goes to a movie that is now a major filmmaker's lowest grossing movie in 35 years. You have to go all the way back to 1978, and I Want to Hold Your Hand to find something by Robert Zemeckis. They made less money than The Walk. This movie made $10.1 million in the U.S. It did a little better overseas, and it didn't cost that much. $35 million is the budget I saw. So it wasn't a studio-destroying bomb, but audiences did not get this movie. But for me, it really was, and I mean this sincerely, not only my favorite movie theater-going experience of the year, but one of my favorite of my entire life. That's not to say it's my favorite movie of the year. I think there are better movies, and I think that, like, The Walk is not a movie I would necessarily recommend to someone to watch on their laptop, on their television. Because part of what made it so essential was to see it in preferably on an IMAX screen and in 3D. At home, it's just not going to be as good. But on the big screen, wow. It was just a thing to behold. It was like you literally felt like you were thousands of feet in the air. My hands were sweating. My armpits were sweating. I was having like shivers. I couldn't sit still. I cried a little. It is a workout for your emotions, or it was at least on the big screen. So, of course, it only made $10 million.
Yeah, this is a movie that other
You didn't
than,
get it either?
Well, when he does The Walk, I think it's sublime.
Right.
Everything going up to that, I found, like, verging on intolerable.
And that is what a lot of people said. You know, it got an okay Rotten Tomatoes rating, 85%, but only a 70 on Metacritic, which means a lot of people thought it was fine, but there wasn't a lot of nerds like me who were really, really passionate about it. And yours was the typical critique. You were certainly in the majority here. The character's very broad. The story of Philippe Petit walking on this wire between the Twin Towers we've seen before in Man on Wire. And it's really only the part on the towers that's worth watching. And that's definitely the best part. I don't dispute that. That's the transcendent part. But I actually got kind of swept up in the whole thing. And I liked Joseph Gordon-Levitt as Philippe Petit. And I liked the supporting cast, Ben Kingsley, James Badge Dale. And what I connected with in this movie was the way that I felt like Zemeckis was using Philippe Petit's story as his muse to tell a story about movie making and a particular right now.
And love movies that are a metaphor for movie making.
I always do. I'm a sucker for them. I won't dispute it. But the fact, you know, the fact that he made this movie, which you can't watch on an iPhone or a laptop, that it has to be seen on a big screen, an IMAX screen, no less, to really get the full effect. That is as suicidal a gesture as walking between the Twin Towers to me. And he didn't make it. This movie was a huge disaster. It made no money. No one went to see it. And people are going to watch it. The few people that watch it at home are going to go, well, that wasn't very good, because they're not there. They are literally not going to get it at that point. So people did not get The Walk. They're going to continue to not get it now that they can't see it on a movie screen. But I loved it. And honestly, if I had a movie theater, we would show The Walk like once a year at least, you know, in 3D. And I would try to, you know, convert as many people as I could to my new love of The Walk. And it might not be successful, but God, I really love this movie. They didn't get it, though, including you, Allison.
Yep, I don't see it.
Yeah, well, that's fine. That's fine.
I suspect you're not going to go with me on my pick either.
All right, what is it?
It is We Are Your Friends, currently available for rent, directed by Catfish, the TV show host Max Joseph in his feature film directorial debut, and starring
Zac Efron, yes,
as Cole Carter, who dreams of stardom and escape as a famous EDM DJ.
You managed to find a huge movie that was actually less successful than mine. So
there
kudos
several,
to you.
There were several giant, like, epic flops this year.
Gem and the Holograms.
Yes. Victor Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And this was one of them. This was one of the first. And this was like, this made no money at all.
Yeah, I think like $7 million.
Yeah. It is actually, I think, it manages a balance for its characters where it understands that they are kind of like idiot bros, their aspirations are not necessarily realistic for most of them, or like that grand, and yet it takes them seriously, and I think in a very even-handed way that turns out to be weirdly moving. I never expected that a movie in which Zac Efron cries while DJing his like kind of great, like his first big break at a giant outdoor summer concert, like that shouldn't be a moment that could be pulled off in a movie, and yet it weirdly works. It is, I think, one of like the perfect uses of Zac Efron in his kind of unreal frat boy looks, and also his like extreme but kind of shallow earnestness. It fits around that perfectly to create the story that I think is like very satisfying. I have no doubt this movie will find a following on like television.
Mm.
It seems exactly like that. In fact, I think it kind of reminds me.
So you're predicting they will eventually get it.
They will eventually get it.
Okay.
I think it reminds me a bit of like those kind of those 90s coming of age movies that were built around a particular cultural moment, like SLC Punk.
Okay.
Or not Go, but the other rave movie. Many of them, not all of these are very good, but I think that
they speak to people who actually like those things.
Yeah, and there's something kind of comfort foody about them.
Okay.
You know, and I think that this is actually a little better than those, and also has a hilarious Wes Bentley as a
love,
like 36 year old like has been DJ. And
God
he's
bless
written,
Wes Bentley.
Like the way he's written, he's like a hard drinking character who like lost, you know, the magic that he used to have. He's written like he is like 65 years old. He is not even 40. Like it's hilarious.
He's our
and
age.
He like groans about like your generation, this and that to Zac Efron,
oh,
and
no.
It is delightful. This movie, I felt like it got its characters, who were these like kids growing up in the valley, who kind of like stand, look at Los Angeles, which is literally a few exits down the freeway, like it's this world away, you know?
Like, I like how you put yourself out there with this one, Allison.
I
41% on Rotten Tomatoes.
I do not think it is a masterpiece.
46 on Metacritic.
But I think it's actually really satisfying. I think like Matt Dentler said, and I think this is absolutely true, if it had been directed by someone else and had gone to Sundance, there would have been a huge bidding war.
Wow.
Because it is absolutely the kind of movie that if it had been discoverable.
Ah.
That people had been like, oh, it's a really good debut.
It didn't have the indie
really
cred
good,
this kind of thing would need.
It did not. And I think it fell right into this terrible gap where it was neither big enough nor small enough and totally flopped. But, you know, I totally enjoyed it.
I got to admit, I haven't seen it. I didn't see it, so I can't.
And everyone else.
I can't disagree with you on it. I haven't gotten the award screener for that one yet.
No,
that one hasn't shown up. So weird. It's probably
funny
lost
that
in the mail.
It got like a Furious 7 award screener, but not...
Are you implying that Furious 7 is not a masterpiece?
I am implying it.
Not in my presence.
All of the awards.
All right, that's what I thought. Shall we move on to our next category?
Let's.
All right, the next category, sort of similar on a smaller scale, is best unappreciated or underappreciated performance. So, you know, at this time of year especially, so many actors and performances, it's just that handful. It's all the talk about acting and actors. It just comes down to that half a dozen men and women who are the ones who are vying for the awards, you know? And it just becomes such an echo chamber. It feels this year maybe even more than usual. I don't know why, but it just seems like if I have to hear someone talk about Michael Fassbender and Steve Jobs one more time when that movie wasn't that great and he wasn't even that great, I'm going to lose my mind. So that's why we wanted to appreciate someone who's been underappreciated. Allison, who is your Svoovie Award winner in this category?
All right, I am giving this prize to Jessica Chastain in Crimson Peak.
Oh.
As Lady Lucille Sharp, who's, I think, in a movie that, for me, never quite figured out where it stood in terms of, like, between homage
it's
and, like,
it's a gothic
drama.
Romance, Allison.
I've been told.
It's a gothic
many
romance.
Times, including on a flyer that was passed out to me ahead of the screening. Like,
are you
literally,
serious?
Yes, like a foreword written by Guillermo del Toro that like explained what gothic romance is, which
really?
I think I've never so clearly seen a sign that a movie is like doomed, like a sign of surrender, than like that you have to explain your genre.
I will say I saw it at a secret screening at Fantastic Fest where Guillermo del Toro was present, and one of the things he said was, "This is not a horror film." Like he did that same thing in word vocal form yes. and explained to all of us what a gothic romance was. But anyway, continue.
I think that. So much of this movie kind of like wavers between wanting to be like a straightforward film of this genre and being an homage and being like verging on parody sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think the only person who kind of finds a good, compelling middle ground is Jessica Chastain, who is like both. She's hilarious sometimes. I mean, she is bound so tight and like looks so like, you know, the housekeeper in Rebecca. And yet is also kind of femme fatale-ish almost in terms of her place in the story. And I just think it is figures out a place between taking this very seriously and taking being deeply committed to this character with this wild backstory. Mm-hmm. And then having just a touch of camp, like just enough camp, you know? And I think that in a movie in which like the two characters involved, the main characters in the romance, are both like such milquetoasty.
Big thumb down. Yes. I'm giving the thumbs down. The listeners can't see, but that's what I'm doing.
Are so kind of like, and I think part like by design, mostly just kind of like pallid, like milquetoast characters. She's the one that you end up cheering for.
Yeah, she's someone with real passion.
Yes, she wants
for a gothic romance. I just didn't feel any romance or passion there except from her character.
Yes, and I God knows Jessica Chastain doesn't need any more praise. Like, she's not an actress who has been underappreciated. But in this role, I think you see her as someone who can be fun, which is something that it's easy to forget. You know, she can be fun and she can be funny. Mm-hmm. Like, she is funny, I think, in this movie in ways that I really enjoyed. And in ways that kind of, when she's doing things like brushing dead butterflies on Mia Wasikowska's face, like, I loved that. And I kind of, that's when you see, like, kind of the signs of life in the movie are moments like that.
Yeah.
You know? So that, I would say she was the best part of that movie for me, easily. Jessica Chastain, you are the best underappreciated performance of the year for me. How about you?
Yeah, I was not a huge fan of that movie, but I like that pick. She was definitely the best part, and she was certainly underappreciated for what she did in that movie. So kudos to you. I like that one.
You.
Yes. Now, for this category, I went with someone who is getting plenty of attention this year, deserving attention, I think, for a big Oscar movie, but zero attention for another movie, which was actually one of my favorite performances of the year and is definitely not an Oscar movie, and that is Cate Blanchett, who will, I think, definitely be nominated for an Academy Award for Carol, and I'm totally cool with that. She's wonderful in that movie. But I also really loved her as the wicked stepmother in Cinderella. And I call her the wicked stepmother because that's what she's always called in Cinderella. But what I loved about this performance was the way that Cate Blanchett made her more wounded than wicked. And that this is a woman who's basically been just as beat up by life or worse than Cinderella has. She's had two marriages to two husbands. Both of them died. She's left to take care of these horrible daughters that she clearly hates and doesn't like. And that doesn't excuse the way she mistreats Cinderella, but it illustrates what the whole movie is about. The whole movie has this beautiful message about have courage and be kind. That's what the whole movie was about. And I like the way that Cinderella and the Cate Blanchett character, Lady Tremaine, they become two sides of the same coin. One of them has courage and is kind, and the other one isn't. And you sort of get to compare them that way. And I thought that was just a nice, lovely way to reinterpret this story we've seen a million times. And Cate Blanchett was so great as this character and really turned this simplistic character into, I thought, a very kind of interesting and multidimensional person. You know, there was, maybe this was a little bit of the Brana that directing it, Kenneth Branagh directing the movie. But there was something in that last sort of big confrontation between Lady Tremaine and Cinderella. That was like almost Shakespearean stuff going on there. She's holding the glass slipper. I thought that was a great scene. Maybe I'm biased because my wife is the biggest Cinderella fan in the world. And so I got to see this with her and she really liked it. But I really liked it, too. I thought this was a really nice version of this story. And without Cate Blanchett, it wouldn't work a quarter as well. She really, I thought, was absolutely wonderful in this movie.
I think she's great in it, too, though I think she kind of disrupts the movie for me. Like, I was not
you didn't like
a
the
fan
movie
of this
that
movie
much
as you were. But I think that in ways she brings like so much kind of like actual economic and like, you know, realism,
right?
Like social realism to this character who had to marry not for love because she needed to support her daughters and all of that. That I think that it just made me just not care about Cinderella when she's like, she literally, all of her choices are not about, like, she doesn't care about kind of like having how to support herself or like, right, what would happen to the house or all of that. And I just feel like a movie in which it's like, well, don't care about those things and you'll be rewarded with the prince. I didn't side with, you know, Cate Blanchett's character because she's evil and does some very cruel things.
Sure.
But I kind of felt like my sympathies were aligned with her as someone who seems to live in a real world,
right,
as opposed to the fairy tale that
maybe
her stepdaughter
is. She was almost too good for the movie for you.
There you go.
Well, I thought she was wonderful, and she's really having, I mean, she's always great, but she is really on quite a roll lately. And I love Carol. I think Carol's great, and she is incredible in that movie as well. But, you know, if you haven't seen Cinderella, if you thought, oh, it's just a kid's movie, and, you know, it is a kid's movie. But if the opportunity arises to see it, don't necessarily, you know, shrug it off. And at the very least, I think what we're both saying is you will get a great Cate Blanchett performance. So she's my underappreciated performance of 2015. Allison, let's get to one of our fan-suggested categories, shall we?
Yeah, let's.
This one was suggested by someone on Twitter, one of our followers on Twitter. Our Twitter account, of course, is @FilmSpottingSVU. This was recommended by @CareBearJerry. Thank you, Jerry. Jerry's suggestion was best spy movie of the year, and there certainly have been a lot of good ones.
There have been.
It's been a very, if you like spy movies, this has been a very good year for you. Allison, you want to go first this time?
Yes, I will. I chose a movie. I figured I knew what movie you would pick, so I chose another one. But I also wanted to give a shout out to Man from U.N.C.L.E., which,
yes,
while not like a masterpiece, is a really fun movie.
Very stylish.
Really didn't get talked about and kind of went away, and it's a good time.
Was swamped out by, because there were so many. I think it came at a bad time of the year because it was coming on the heels of some, I think, still better spy movies.
Yes, and also I don't think that it had the brand recognition.
Nobody except my dad.
Yes.
Hi, Dad. I love you, and I'm glad we went to see this movie together, in fact. But he's the only person that cares or at least remembers and enjoyed The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if you did, it wasn't really like the TV show. It was like an origin story. It was like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Begins, so it really was for no one.
So just wanted to throw it a mention.
Nice. Yeah,
there.
It was fine.
But the movie that I'm going to pick is Spy, fittingly. The comedy starring Melissa McCarthy with a particularly delightful Jason Statham as a character.
Wonderful.
Who basically is a spoof of kind of his more badass characters and gives a lot of monologues about impossible feats of secret agency, among other things. I think my favorite line is where he shows up in a suit impossibly, and he's asked where he got the suit, and he said, "I made it, didn't I?" And you feel like maybe he could make that suit. But I also really liked the ways in which Melissa McCarthy played a character who was like good, potentially very good at what she could do, and took herself out of the equation, you know, because she was so smitten with the character played by Jude Law that she made herself his backup, the character that you see in a lot of shows who usually looks more like Melissa McCarthy and is the person in the headset,
right,
who stays at the desk and, you know, shouts out instructions and Googles things. And I really liked the ways in which this movie took that type of character and then, you know, put her out into the field.
Yeah.
And also never let her have the kind of glamorous spy fantasy that she wanted. There's an ongoing joke in it that whenever she's handed a cover, it's always like a cat lady.
Super dowdy lady.
Yes,
that
wearing
she has to
some
play.
Kind of,
yes,
like novelty sweater.
Yes.
And is like on
really
vacation
good.
While like using her unemployment or something. Mm-hmm. Like, it's always, the stories are always extremely not glamorous. But that she kind of, you know, Melissa McCarthy, I think, still leans into slapstick in ways that I don't always love. And I feel like there's a type of role that she seems to expect that she's got to do, or type of comedy that she expects she's got to do, that even in a movie like this that really tries to push her in different directions, she ends up doing sometimes. And I don't always love that. But I loved the kind of sweetness to this about how she had to figure out a way to be a spy that did not fit in with any of the cliches. And I thought that worked out really well in this movie. And, you know, it's got a lot of great little performances, but it's also actively trying to figure out a way to fit Melissa McCarthy into a genre that really doesn't have a place for her,
right,
out, you know, like out actually involved in the business of spying.
Yes.
So I really like that, Spy. That is my pick for Best Spy Movie.
Not the movie I expected you to say. I was sort of expecting we might hear a little Mission Impossible love here.
I thought about it, but then I think I feel like we've talked about it before, and I do really enjoy it.
Yeah, no, I don't think I liked Spy quite as much as you did, but you hit on the things that work the best about it. Jason Statham is really, really funny.
He's fantastic.
And fantastic. And yeah, it's very clever in the way that it's taking this character type of these movies, where the woman is always sidelined, and it lets her, you know, get out in the field, but it also it's having a lot of fun with all these different things. And I think even wasn't one of the big fights in the movie in a kitchen, you know, like it's like almost literally like poking at people who are like making fun of women and telling them to do stereotypical things. It's like, oh, we're gonna stick it to those guys. And I thought that was great, and I think we need more movies like that for sure.
Absolutely.
All right, so as we've already said, very good year for spy movies. You mentioned The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I wanted to make sure to do that. Rogue Nation also.
It's great.
Very good. For me, though, and I'm sure this is you were expecting this, it's a no-brainer. It's got to be, not just because the word spy is in the title, but Bridge of Spies, the latest film from Steven Spielberg. It's got Tom Hanks playing basically an ordinary guy with a very strong moral compass. He's drafted into the Cold War to be the defense attorney for this Russian spy who's been captured. And if you're an espionage fan, you know, movie-wise, I mean, not necessarily the concept of espionage in the real world, this movie really, I thought, had everything. It had chase scenes. It has one really incredible action set piece. This, like, that crashing sequence was really incredible. It's got suspense. And it's got plenty of ideas to chew over about the nature of good and evil, right and wrong, honor, duty, and on and on and on. It is Spielberg and Hanks doing Frank Capra and Jimmy Stewart. It's them doing John Ford and Henry Fonda. And it's about how even in a time of war, you can win, or they would probably argue you only win by maintaining your principles and your decency and not stooping to the level of an enemy who's not as principled as you. And that seemed pretty timely to me when it came out. I feel like a month or two later, with the way things are going, it's maybe an only more urgent the message of this movie. So it's almost a shame that a movie that's about something that took place this long ago is still so relevant and timely. But I haven't had a chance to rewatch this movie. This is one of my favorite movies either that I haven't gotten to rewatch yet, but I would like to. I really would. I hope it holds up as well as it did on the first viewing, because on first viewing, I was just totally in love with this movie. I think you said it was a very dad movie.
It's an extremely dad movie.
I'm going to be a dad in a few weeks, so I'm allowed to like it. That's my excuse.
I like this movie too. But I would argue it does the exact same thing that Spy does, which is it dumps a character who is like a...
Very fair.
You know, a tax attorney.
I can't disagree. That's right.
And puts him into this role as a spy.
Right.
And then suggests that there are ways in which you are a better spy because of that, because you do not come in with the same kind of like jaded...
And relying on your intellect as opposed to necessarily your physical skills as a murderous hitman.
Yeah. Also, Mark Rylance in this movie is...
Amazing.
Is great.
Fantastic. Yes. Okay, so... Those are our Best Spy movies. Thank you at Care Bear Jerry for the suggestion. We have one more audience suggested category. It is from listener Kino Kabir at KINOKABIR on Twitter. And we tweaked the name of it slightly. We're going with it as the most grueling watch of 2015. Our friend Dave Chen has an expression he uses on his podcast a lot, the Slash Film Cast. A good sit. A movie is a good sit. These would be the opposites of a good sit.
A hard sit.
A hard sit, a bad sit. A movie that you had you squirming, checking your watch. You couldn't wait for it to be over. Allison, should I go first this time?
Why don't you go first?
All right. So, for the most grueling watch, this was one I thought about a lot. Because there are bad movies and then there's bad movies. And there are arguably much worse movies than my choice. But when I think of painful experiences, I think when something is truly punishing, not just bad, there has to be some sort of like failure in it. If it's just bad and you expect it to be bad and it's just boring, like that's one thing. But where a movie feels like it should be good, whether it's the premise, the filmmakers, whatever it is, and that you can almost sense amidst the crap that there's a good movie buried beneath it, that's the really terrible thing to watch. So that's why my pick this year is Chappie from Neil Blomkamp, a director who has gone from Wunderkind to Dummkopf about as quickly as anyone since M. Night Shyamalan. And at least M. Night Shyamalan, to his credit, had three good movies, good to great movies in a row before he fell off a cliff. Neil Blomkamp fell from grace faster than a robot dies when you take out its guard key in Chappie, which is very fast. So the premise here, if you didn't see the film, lucky you, was basically Short Circuit meets RoboCop. You have this police robot that is given basically real human consciousness, and there are so many interesting things you could do with this. and explore ideas like nature versus nurture, the existence of a soul, humanity's obsession and reliance on technology. How many of these ideas does Chappie actually explore, Allison?
None of them.
Not really any of them. It's just super violent and not even that interesting an action movie in which this supposedly brilliant scientist played by Dev Patel basically gives his robot to these bank robbers played by Ninja and Yolandi Visser from the South African band Die Antwoord. They're basically playing themselves.
Yep.
But instead of being a hip-hop group, they are criminals and terrible actors. I think that's the characters they're playing. And they teach Chappie how to be a gangster, how to talk like a gangster, how to wear big chains, how to shoot an AK-47. Oh, God, I'm getting upset just thinking about this movie again, Allison. It's, you know, it's almost a metaphor for itself because it is about how this innocent soul is corrupted by violence. And the movie itself, its search for any kind of meaning is also corrupted by shootouts and gunfire and violence. So that's kind of interesting. I'm not sure that was deliberate, but either way, it doesn't make the movie any more enjoyable or less painful to watch. And I was actively annoyed through most of like the second two thirds of this movie. And I haven't even mentioned Hugh Jackman and his hideous haircut as another robot designer who is so stupid. You know, I heard he just got hired by Jurassic Park to spearhead their work in Jurassic World 2. He'll fit in right there. So there are a couple other movies I could have put on here. I almost picked Pixels. There are moments in Pixels that are worse than anything in Chappie,
sure.
But Chappie is more consistently horrible. So I hate you, Chappie. Sorry.
Fair enough. No disputes here.
All right. What was your most grueling watch of 2015, Allison?
Well, even though it's a good movie, I felt like I should give one quick shout out to Out One here, which was literally grueling in that it was 13 hours.
Okay.
And, you know, was a hard watch.
That's physically. Fair. Very fair.
By the way, you can still stream that on Fandor. But my pick for this is a movie that, you know, I think we've talked before about comedians who do dramatic roles and how sometimes they manage to push themselves in kind of like ways that are great, but other times they pick like material that just you think no one should, whether it's schmaltzy or in this case just I think terribly, terribly written. It is I Smile Back, which is available to rent now, directed by Adam Salke and written by Amy Koppelman. It's based on the novel she wrote and stars Sarah Silverman as Lainey, who is this upper-middle-class housewife and mother who has a seemingly perfect life. Her husband is played by Josh Charles. He clearly loves her. She has two cute kids and this really nice house. And we learn very quickly she's been having an affair. She drinks. She does all these drugs except for meds for her bipolar disorder, which she's gone off of. And it's just like, I feel like it approaches kind of camp, like unhappy housewife camp, in the ways in which it just shows this character in like constant like bad behavior. It turns mental illness and depression into like acting out in ways that I think are actually offensive.
Ooh.
And then there are scenes in this that are just, I can't believe that like this movie actually did not, it got some positive reviews that I was a little shocked by. I mean, there are scenes in which Lainey does things like gets really blitzed on pills and liquor, crawls into her daughter's room, masturbates using her teddy bear on the floor, and then curls up in the fetal position and cries. And I just could not believe that a movie actually like gave that, like presented that very seriously as like a kind of act of drama. And I do not think Sarah Silverman is bad in this, but she gives her all to material that really I don't think deserves it. And that it tries to do something that I think is kind of like fundamentally a noble thing, which is to say that depression has nothing to do with, you can be depressed in like perfectly stable,
sure,
you know, like white picket fence scenarios, as well as having things bad happen to you. But I feel like this movie and the ways in which it portrays depression are just like, are so kind of like over the top and just so, such a weird ball of cliches. And I couldn't believe that someone kind of signed on. So many people signed on for this. Talented people signed on for this and kind of devoted a lot of energy to this. I would like to see Sarah Silverman do more dramatic roles. I think there's like potential to be seen here. But this was painful for me to watch. It was grueling.
And it has a better Rotten Tomatoes and Metacritic score than We Are Your Friends.
Wow. Just saying.
So what you're saying here, Allison, is you did not smile back.
I did not smile back.
All right.
Frowns only.
I frown back. Harumph. All right. Let's move on to our next Sfoovy Award category. This is a fun one. This is Best On-Screen Couple. Best On-Screen Couple. Allison, I want you to go first this time.
All right. I'll go first. We decided this wouldn't necessarily be romantic.
Did not
we
have to
be. We
opened
this up to all possibilities.
Any couple on screen.
And the movie I picked is not a romantic pairing. It is Jason Segel as David Foster Wallace and Jesse Eisenberg as David Lipsky in The End of the Tour. This is a movie that I liked the middle part of a lot, and I hated the framing device. It's, you know, David Foster Wallace committed suicide. This is based on interviews that David Lipsky did with him, an interview that never actually got published for a profile for Rolling Stone that never got published. And then when David Foster Wallace committed suicide, David Lipsky looked up these recordings and ended up publishing a book. And the framing device is that it starts with him learning about David Foster Wallace's suicide. It kind of ends with him reading from the book in ways that I think turn this all into a weird anecdote of that time I hung out with the famous writer who was, you know, depressive. That said, the whole bits of the interviews I think are pretty wonderful, and it obviously pulls a lot from the conversation that the two actually had, and really interestingly shows a character. It is a good movie about magazine profile writing because you have this character who is trying to write a profile of another character who is a writer who has written profiles and knows exactly what he's doing, and the kind of duel that they're having and the self-awareness that David Foster Wallace's character has over how he thinks he's coming across leads to this kind of power switch that I really liked. I think there's one part where he says, "I don't even know if I like you yet, but I'm so nervous if you like me." And, you know, it's a very good Jason Segel performance with his character who is so smart, but also so almost like cripplingly self-aware of how he was perceived and of fame and wanting to get away from that, but also kind of being very conscious of it. There are lots of like just wonderful little scenes, including the ones in which you're made very aware that to be a good interviewer really means not trying to make friends with someone. You're not their friends. In fact, like the things that might be best for an interview are things that the person you're interviewing doesn't want published necessarily, including parts where David Lipsky kind of pokes at his personal life and asks questions about depression and drug use that, you know, don't go over well. But they're also both colleagues. They're both writers, and there's some jealousy there as well. There's like a wealth of kind of complications between them that come out in dialogue that I really appreciated. So for a movie that I was very mixed on for reasons I've explained, I think that like it's got some really fantastic exchanges and that are very well acted. So that is my pick, The End of the Tour.
That's a very good pick. I like that movie. I might like that movie more than you did, but I actually didn't think of them for this category, but that's a really good choice. They're great together. They kind of have a little of that Inglourious Bastards vibe of sort of the kind of battle of the wills and sort of the poker game of a dialogue conversation that's the best parts of Bastards is kind of what all of that movie is they're each trying to feel each other out. They're saying things. They might be holding some things back. They're trying to read one another.
Yeah.
And you're right. It really does show, and not in an always flattering way.
No,
and I think,
in some ways that are sometimes excruciating.
Yeah, especially as a writer myself, like the Jesse Eisenberg character or the David Lipsky character, I related to him at times in that movie in ways I was almost uncomfortable with. Like, it hurt me to say that looks like me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's a part towards the end where he runs around
he's listening
into his recorder all of these
details
about the house
to put
for color
for
the piece that it's like, I just like curled up in a ball in like pained recognition.
At least they weren't eating truffle fries. That's all you could say. That would have really made it really rough. That's a real inside baseball joke. Okay. My on-screen couple. Thought a lot about this one. I did not think of The End of the Tour, but I did think about Nina Haas and Ronald Zerfeld from Phoenix.
They were fantastic.
I thought about Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart in Clouds of Sils Maria.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about Vin Diesel and Paul Walker in Furious 7.
Ah, white boy, it's here.
It's a beautiful, beautiful on-screen couple there. But I eventually went with what had been my first choice. I just went with my gut, and I picked Ciara Diana and Sidzi Babett Knudsen from The Duke of Burgundy. And here are two characters who I personally seemingly have very little in common with. They're gay and I'm straight. They enjoy sadomasochism. I do not. They get their kicks from using human toilets. And as far as you, Allison, or anyone listening other than my wife knows, I do not get my kicks from using human toilets. But this couple who have these eccentric tastes, I think, combine, and the performances together give you this wonderful portrait of what's ultimately a very universal and even in some ways mundane relationship, and how all relationships are about finding compromise and working through problems and, you know, sort of focusing on what you love in another person and all of that other stuff that's sort of the sexy stuff, quote unquote, is all the window dressing. And that when you get right down to the core of it, it is just about what marriage is, which is love and compromise. And, you know, like I watched this movie not really knowing what to expect. And then I saw in some ways my life. And I think there's something very beautiful about that. Making something that's so lurid and set in this strange universe where there are no men at all, not a single man exists. Everyone is either an expert on butterflies or an amateur expert on butterflies. And yet I still found something so relatable and very true about this movie. And Deanna and Knudsen are so great together. They have, again, it's another movie where it's kind of, there's a little bit of a poker face thing going on here, especially at the start of the movie when you first meet these characters. You don't know quite what the relationship is, what the power dynamic is. And as it goes on, we get to see all of that evolve, how they relate to one another, who has the upper hand. And then there is that element of sensuality between them. There is, it's restrained, but there's definitely some chemistry between them as well. So they're great. You know, I would love to see these characters again. Maybe a sequel, a TV series, a sitcom about the lives of these characters. I would be down for that. But it has to be very strange and humdrum. They have to kind of keep that balance. That would be the important part. So that is my on-screen couple of the year from The Duke of Burgundy.
Good pick. It's a great movie.
Our next Svoovie Award, and we're getting down here. We've got two more categories. Our second to last category here, Allison, best conversation piece of the year. Not necessarily the best movie. Didn't even have to be a good movie, I suppose.
Yeah.
Just the movie that you had the most, what would you say, the most rich discussions? It provoked the most interesting discussions?
Yeah. I think that describes it.
Shall I go first?
Why
this
don't
time?
You go first? Sure.
So my runner-up actually for this award would be a bad movie, which was Fantastic Four. Frankly, the worst movie of the year, but one of the most interesting to discuss because it was so poorly made and so obviously hacked to pieces.
And also, and you could see these ghosts of ideas of what it seemed to be going for.
And you would sit there with people who had seen it and say, okay, this part, was this Josh Trank's idea or was this the ghost editor, director, whoever, who came in, was this a reshoot? Was this the editors after the fact? Like, how did this? And then some of their decisions were so baffling to, like, fix it, quote unquote, that you would just sit there and it provoked actually a lot of interesting discussions. Plus the whole eating the Denny's menu. People still want to talk about that, eating the entire Denny's novelty Fantastic Four menu. So I definitely had a lot of conversations about that movie. But in terms of really like rich, intense discussions, both about the sort of cinematic qualities of something, but also bigger ideas about humanity, philosophy, sexuality, psychology, technology. For me, the movie, the winner has to be Ex Machina. Basically, everything I wanted out of Chappie, I got here in Alex Garland's very interesting movie about the world's first artificial intelligence, this robot named Ava, played by Alicia Vikander, who's been given this Turing test of her potential humanity by her creator, played by Oscar Isaac, and one of his very naive underlings, played by Domhnall Gleeson. And in terms of, again, that richness of debate and discussion, this was the movie that I definitely had the best, and both best and most of this year, you know, debating whether that robot character has a conscience, whether the ending is a happy ending or a sad ending, whether Oscar Isaac is a true villain or not, whether Domhnall Gleeson is in some ways the villain of the movie, or if at least he's a good person or a bad person. And I even found that I saw the movie twice, and seeing it a second time, I felt my own attitudes about some of these characters really shifted and changed. Like, you see the movie the first time very much from the Domhnall Gleeson's character's perspective, because you're sort of new to this world. And then when you know what's going to happen, I don't know, I really felt like I was seeing it more in some scenes through Oscar Isaac's eyes, which was a very interesting thing to do. So that, to me, is the clear winner here. Ex Machina, a movie that is, I believe, is available for rent already and certainly worth people checking out.
I believe it's streaming on Amazon Prime.
Okay,
now.
I'll double check to make sure. But yeah, that's a movie that people missed it. Some people love it. Some people aren't as hot on it. But I do find that even people who don't like it, it's a rich movie. It provokes a lot of talking.
Yeah, it does what you want from smart sci-fi, which is it lobs all of these interesting ideas out there. Yeah,
you're right. It is on Amazon Prime right now.
It's a great movie. My movie is not one that I would call a great movie, but is by far the one that I have discussed the most this year, which is 50 Shades of Grey.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
The adaptation of E.L. James' bestseller about sadomasochism, more sadomasochism in this podcast than I would have expected, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson with a screenplay by Kelly Marcel. And I feel like this movie, I don't feel like I'm particularly attached to this movie as like as something that I like all that much. I feel like I've done so much defending of it, both because I think there was a crowd that automatically kind of sniggered about it as like, you know, a piece of erotica, which often without seeing it, or often just by finding the concept, hilarious, which I think is dismissive and kind of just dumb, like a kind of dumb approach. And then all of the kind of other side of it, which is that I feel like there's so many attacks on it from the side of people who are saying like this is glorifying an abusive relationship.
Right, inherently offensive.
Right, that this is inherently offensive, mostly from people who had read I have not read the book still. I don't really care about the book. But like mostly people coming in from the book and saying like bringing those same criticisms to the movie, often as well without seeing it. And I feel like there are so many interesting things in this movie that is like a fairly silly, but also like, I think Sam Taylor Johnson managed to pull a less silly than maybe one might have expected.
And it could have been,
yes,
perhaps. Yeah, I'd say that's fair.
Yeah. With at least, I think Dakota Johnson bringing some life to Anastasia Steele, a virginal,
now you gotta say it.
Exactly. Well, a virginal college student who ends up in this masochistic relationship with Christian Grey, played by Jamie Dornan, who looked miserable the whole movie.
He looks so sad.
But I think that what is most interesting to me about this movie, and is the conversation I've had a lot, beyond, I think, the idea that it glorifies an abusive relationship, which I don't think it does, but it are the ways in which it's not, I think, a particularly feminist movie, but it is an extremely feminine movie and a feminine fantasy. It is like a female written story that I think reflects a lot of kind of literary kind of tropes in terms of like female written romance, from like Bodice Rippers to Jane Eyre, in terms of like trying to, you know, reform a rake, in terms being kind of like a ravishment fantasy of this like experienced older man, and also in terms of this person, like in terms of kind of like melting the stony heart, right? Like getting this character who's emotionally aloof and removed, and kind of changing them and opening them
I'll
up.
I'll fix him.
Yes. And these are things that have been in like female written literature for a long time. And it's been like, I don't know that I've ever seen them on screen so kind of like nakedly, not just in the literal sense, you know, that to have so kind of unabashedly a story like this, that I think is usually now these days like kind of pushed aside to romance, you know, like romance literature or fan fiction, frankly. And this started as fan fiction, and I think brings, I think, a tone and point of view that may be a little silly looking, but is also, I think, very unabashedly made for female audiences and female pleasure. And I think that even in movies that are supposedly about that and that supposedly cater to that, they usually don't look quite like this. This looked kind of almost alien, you know, I think, in some of the ways in which it tried to serve its audience. And I I found that fascinating. I had a lot of conversations about this movie, and I think it is one of the most interesting movies of the year, even if I don't think it's a terribly successful movie. I think I'm still really interested to talk about it. I have no idea what's going to become of the second movie with E.L. James stepping in and taking more of a role. That sounds dreadful to me, but maybe also, I think, probably going to be fascinating in its own
right.
It might
be worse and even more interesting at the
exactly,
same time. Yeah,
as well. Yep. But, you know, I think that line between being like, that the idea that a female fantasy, something that is servicing a female fantasy, is not necessarily a story about a totally empowered, you know, like, character, because that's not the point of the movie, is not representation, but is serving this audience who is looking to be indulged. So 50 Shades of Grey, had a lot of conversations about it. Happy to have one with you.
So when next time you see Allison, just be like, hey, what about them?
Let's talk it out.
Let's hash out all these shades of gray. Yeah. I think I largely agree with you. I mean, I don't think it's a good movie, but it's not that far from being a good movie, and it's certainly an interesting movie. I do feel like Jamie Dornan, I mean, I know that was sort of like compromise casting from the beginning. He was a replacement at the last minute. I kind of feel like if you replace him with somebody else, it's like almost instantly like a good movie. Maybe not a great movie, but like a pretty decent sort of movie for a lot of the reasons
and
you're talking about.
You know, we see a lot of movies that are male fantasies, like half of like big movies are
I don't believe that it's true at all.
Male fantasies.
Harumph.
And that are kind of like cater to male fantasies.
Absolutely.
And I feel like this is what a blockbuster looks like.
Right.
That is aimed like unabashedly caters to female fantasies.
Right.
And there's something
that alone, very interesting.
There's something to that.
And there should be more of that, frankly. That's what I say. All right. We're moving on to our very last Sfoovie Award of the night. And this is probably my favorite Sfoovie Award every year. And that is when we predict the best movie of next year, sight unseen. It is cheating to pick a movie that you've seen that doesn't open till next year that you love. That
right.
is not allowed. And generally, we don't even pick anything that sort of played places. So if you haven't seen it, but you know that it's well reviewed at the Toronto Film Festival.
That doesn't count.
Now, every year we fact check ourselves from the previous year and we discuss what our picks were. Allison, did you go back and look? Am I going to surprise you? Okay.
Surprise me.
So last year, you picked one movie, but you mentioned another. I'm going to tell you both.
Okay.
Now, you claimed it would be cheating, even though it doesn't violate any of those rules, for you to have picked Mad Max Fury Road.
Because the trailer had come out,
and it was an incredible trailer.
It was an amazing trailer.
Right. And I mean, that was a strong choice, even though that wasn't your official choice. That was a very strong choice.
That's fantastic.
We haven't mentioned it once in the Sfoovies, but that's probably just because it's more the movie that everyone's going to be talking about on those typical podcasts about the best movies of the year. This has never happened to us before. Your pick for the best movie of 2015 did not open in 2015.
What was it?
It was Midnight Special, the new Jeff Nichols movie, which now is opening, I believe, in March, if I'm correct. That's the sci-fi thriller. Now there is a trailer. It's definitely coming out now. It's been sort of very slow coming. I think it was originally supposed to open in November of this year, certainly in the fall, but they pushed it back, and it's Michael Shannon, and his son has superpowers, and it's like a chase film with a sci-fi twist. And we're big Jeff Nichols fans here, so that was, I thought at the time, a fabulous choice. But
It didn't come out.
So this is like a TV. Now you get to have two best movies of 2016 because that's like your unofficial
gaming
pick.
Gaming the system.
Yes, and my pick, just for the record, was Untitled Cold War Spy Thriller, which became Bridge of Spies, which
Nicely
we talked about
done.
on the show, which was absolutely one of my favorite movies of the year. So it doesn't always work out that well, but our forecasting abilities were very strong last year. We have no idea how well we'll do next year, but it's time to cast those votes in indelible ink. So besides Midnight Special, Allison, what will be the best movie of 2016?
Okay, the best movie of 2016 is going to be The Girl on the Train.
Oh.
Yes. I'm saying this because it is based on this nasty, totally page-turning novel by Paula Hawkins that read really like a lesser Gone Girl, like maybe a little less well-written, or maybe a lot less well-written, depending on how you feel about Gone Girl. But a really kind of like quick, fascinating read with three major female characters, one of whom, the main character, is this heartbroken alcoholic who's a very unreliable narrator because she keeps blacking out.
Okay.
And the cast so far has included Rebecca Ferguson, Emily Blunt, Justin Theroux, Haley Bennett, and Luke Evans. And it is directed by Tate Taylor, who did The Help and then surprised the hell out of me with Get On Up. And I think what's promising to me about that is that Get On Up, you know, jumped through eras and kind of managed to bring all of these threads kind of together.
Yeah.
And this is a movie that goes through multiple characters.
Okay.
And kind of also has a character who has to piece together what happened when she was like blackout drunk and tries to piece together this information. So I think that there's something about the non-linearity of that that makes me think maybe. It's written by Aaron Cressida Wilson, who wrote Secretary, promising. And Men, Women, and Children, less promising. So I'm just...
I like this because on the one hand, sure, it's a bestseller and that cast is incredible.
Fantastic. Rebecca Ferguson, who was so good.
And Emily Blunt.
And Emily Blunt.
I love Emily Blunt.
And Justin Theroux.
And Luke Evans, Edgar Ramirez. It's a very good cast. That said, there's some risk here.
There's absolutely
risk. I like that. I admire it.
You know, I gotta take some chances.
You gotta take some chances.
So how about you? What you got?
It's funny. I feel like I'm taking a little chance here for sort of the opposite. I feel very strong about the filmmaker choices. The cast of my movie is the part that's giving me pause.
Ooh.
It is a movie also based on a book, I believe. It is called The Lost City of Z. And the reason I'm very interested in this one is, again, the director. It's the writer and director. It's James Gray, who's one of my favorite filmmakers, and this is really his first chance to make something bigger, at least as it sounds like it's got to be bigger because it's sort of a exploration movie, right? The plot description is, in 1925, the legendary British explorer Percy Fawcett ventured into the Amazon jungle in search of a fabled civilization. He never returned, .. So all that sounds great. I love the idea of James Gray making a bigger movie. He's tended to make, you know, very small, wonderful character pieces like Two Lovers and The Yards and great movies, but, you know, very small. This, you know, so this seems like he's, you know, busting out, doing something bigger, expanding his vision, which I'm very excited to see. The cast is Charlie Hunnam is the lead role,
okay,
and Sienna Miller is the other lead role.
Ooh, they are kind of like the equivalent of one another, though.
They're both
like, you kind of maybe forget what they look like.
Yeah, and then Robert Pattinson, who actually, that's more promising to me,
yeah,
and Tom Holland, who is the new Spider-Man.
So.
I'm hoping, I don't know for sure, but I'm hoping Charlie Hunnam at least can talk in his British accent. Because if he's talking with an American accent, this is over before it even starts. But I'm hoping that he can be British, at least. I'm pinning a lot of hope, like a lot of hope, Allison, on the fact that he doesn't have to use a bad American accent. But I love James Gray, and that premise sounds really intriguing, too, for a James Gray movie. So
yeah.
I'm just... A little risky choice, too. Not a slam dunk. The other one, I think we would both agree, though, is Gods of Egypt.
Oh,
for
of course.
Sure.
It's going to win all of the Oscars.
Yeah, for sure. Yes. Totally. And if you don't know what we're talking about, Google Gods of Egypt trailer and enjoy, because you will. I promise you will enjoy that trailer. There's no way not to. And no way for that not to be the best movie of 2016. We're going to skip the new releases and head right to Behind the Eight Ball, which is where we round up the new releases on streaming. We give you two listener recommendations and one film chosen blindly by number from our My List, which is now getting even more difficult because Netflix, in their infinite wisdom, decided to eliminate the numbers in your My List. If you've been on your Netflix lately, you'll see that there are now no numbers for your My List.
I had to count down.
Yes, I know. So expect in the future a lot of nothing is ever going to be over like 30.
Yeah.
They're going to be low numbers from now on because we have to count these by hand, which is really annoying. Allison, it's up to you. You want to go first? You want me to go first?
I want to go first.
All right. So let's start here with three new releases.
Okay. First up is a movie I've already talked about in the last episode, but I wanted to mention it because it is new to Netflix. That is Tangerine, one of the great pleasures, the kind of like small indie pleasures of this year. And if you haven't had a chance to watch it in the theaters, now it is streaming on Netflix and you should check it out. Also new to Netflix is a movie I've really been curious about, and I'm happy that it's on there now and I can see it. Black Coal, Thin Ice, 2014 Chinese thriller from Diao Yin Yan. It won the Golden Bear at Berlin last year. It was kind of, I think, a controversial choice, but it is a Chinese detective noir set in northern China, and that sounds great to me. Crime thriller set amidst coal shipments in northern China. So that is Black Coal Thin Ice on Netflix. And finally, new to Fandor and already on Amazon Prime is Christmas Again, which is also, I think, currently in theaters, at least for a short run. It is a little indie about a lonesome Christmas tree vendor in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, my old neighborhood, directed by Charles Pokel, who actually did this job for several years, was a Christmas tree vendor in the streets of New York. And Kentucker Audley, filmmaker and actor, stars as the main character. And it is a nice little film about what it feels like to be glum during the holidays and to work a job of Christmas tree sales. And cinematographer Sean Price Williams, he does a lot of great work, and Robert Greene, another filmmaker, edited. So a lot of great people involved in that. Christmas Again on Fandor and Amazon Prime.
Okay, two listener recommendations.
Okay, first up we have one from Eric, who writes, I just wanted to recommend you a film I came across on Hulu's Criterion section, Elevator to the Gallows, directed by Louis Malle. The film is an extremely stylish and beautiful noir, which surprised me since the only Malle film I'd seen previously was My Dinner with Andre, a film not really remembered for its directorial flair. I don't want to reveal anything about the story since I went in completely fresh, so I'll just say it's kind of like the plots of Double Indemnity and Badlands intertwined. Plus, it has great performances all around, especially from Jean Moreau, and the rare film score from Miles Davis. And also, this is me speaking, Elevator the Gallows, that's such a great title. You can't go wrong with a title like that. So thank you, Eric, for that. And a short recommendation from Brian, who sent us on Twitter and then sent us an email as well, and who points out that Medicine for Melancholy, the movie he just saw last night, is now available on Netflix Instant. And he says, it is a really good movie. I would second that. It's a great one. And the director is finally making a second movie. So look for Barry Jenkins, I think, in the next year. Thank you for that, Brian.
Okay, and one film chosen blindly by number from your unnumbered my list.
You gave me number 23, and when I counted down,
sorry, it'll
slots,
be lower next time.
I found Cheatin', which is the latest film from Bill Plimpton, his seventh feature-length animated feature. He funded it in part on Kickstarter, and is apparently about a beautiful woman who, while strolling through a carnival, ends up being rescued by a handsome, muscular man. They get married, and then there are various threats of infidelity in their marriage. But I'm sure, like all Bill Plimpton things, it is grotesque and beautiful and surreal. But always like Bill Plimpton, who is a true, unique talent. And I'm hoping to get to that one eventually. Okay, Matt, are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, three new releases.
First up on Hulu and Amazon, a whole bunch of films from the Friday the 13th franchise. This year for Halloween, I watched and ranked all 12 films in this series about Jason Voorhees, professional zombie serial killer and amateur hockey goalie. And while a fair number of these are pretty terrible, there are a couple that are really good. I like Part 4, which is inaccurately titled The Final Chapter. That one is a very straight-ahead horror movie with great gore effects. And I really liked Part 6, which is called Jason Lives, which is more of a horror comedy. It kind of plays into the absurdity that the franchise had kind of gathered by that point. And it's almost like a Scream-esque slasher genre deconstruction. It's actually really funny at times while still being pretty scary. That was definitely like the discovery for me of watching them all. I had never seen that one. That was my favorite of the series and my most pleasant surprise. So those are the two I would definitely recommend for horror fans: Friday the 13th Part 4 and Friday the 13th Part 6. Next up, a movie we have discussed at length before on SVU, Michael Mann's Manhunter, the original adaptation of the Hannibal Lecter novel Red Dragon from 1986 with Brian Cox as Lecter and William Peterson as Will Graham. If you're interested in hearing more, you can find that discussion on SVU number 65. We talked about that movie, and we talked about, I think, just about every other Hannibal Lecter movie and the recent Hannibal TV show. That was like an all Hannibal podcast. So if that sounds like your speed, check that out. SVU number 65, Manhunter, is now on Amazon Prime. Finally, I wanted to give a shout out to a relatively new streaming site that I don't think we've discussed on the show before, and I've been using and enjoying, and it's totally free. You don't have to subscribe or sign up. It's all ad-supported, and that's Shout Factory TV. And that's the streaming site connected to the great DVD Blu-ray company Shout Factory. And if you know the name already, Shout Factory, you know they kind of do genre stuff from film and television, cult stuff. that's sort of their milieu. They're also now the official distributor and I think even owners of all things MST3K, and they have a massive section just of MST3K episodes to choose from, which is really cool. I was just watching Mitchell over on Shout Factory TV just last week, and they don't have a gigantic selection of thousands of movies. I think they rotate stuff in and out, but they have several unique and very cool features in addition to the fact that it's totally free. They have this thing called VHS Vault, where some of the movies are presented as if they were on VHS. They're sort of taken straight from VHS tape, so they're pan and scan, and they're a little grainy and fuzzy, and the tracking kind of futzes once in a while, which is great for setting the mood for the right kind of old horror movie. And they also have something that I don't – maybe there are other streaming sites that do this yet. I haven't really seen it, with very few exceptions. They have director's commentaries for a bunch of the movies, which I love director's commentaries. You know, not everything, but there are select titles with director's commentaries. I hope that's a trend that increases as we move towards streaming. So more streaming sites need a director's commentary option. But until then, that's my recommendation. Shout Factory TV. It's a new streaming site, totally free. You don't have to sign up. It's just ad-supported. Kudos to them on a really nice site.
All right, two listener recommendations.
Our first here comes from Jim in Bethpage, New York. He says, he wants us to talk about it, Allison, but we're going to use it as a recommendation. He says, I would really enjoy a discussion on Birdman sometime in the next year on Film Spotting SVU. This is a movie I did not care for when I first saw it, similar to your reactions, but it really does benefit from multiple viewings. Birdman is packed with specific visual details and very nuanced performances that reveal a lot about each character with each subsequent viewing. I'm curious to see if you and Allison have a similar reaction and if you would agree that Michael Keaton's performance is perfect. And that's from Jim in Bethpage, New York. Of course, Birdman is currently available for rental in a lot of different places. Last year's Oscar winner for Best Picture. Allison, would you be interested in doing a Birdman podcast somewhere down the line?
I think so. I liked it.
There you go. Apparently, Jim, I don't know where you're all getting your news, Jim.
Yeah.
I thought it was okay. And seeing it I've already seen it twice. I saw it a second time relatively, you know, in its first release. And I'm sorry, Jim, it didn't really blow me away on second viewing, but I would be up for talking about it. But maybe somewhere next year we will make that a listener's choice option for an upcoming show. So thank you, Jim, for writing in. Next up, we have an email from JM in Vancouver, who writes, Dear SVU team, first of all, thank you for reading a previous listener recommendation of mine. This time I'd like to mainly recommend Joseph Gordon-Levitt's variety show Hit Record on TV. I hadn't heard of it until it was recommended to me through Netflix's algorithm, but I was shocked how little critical promotion the show has gotten. It is a wholly unique experiment utilizing crowdsourced content to explore broader topics with intimate projects. Suitably, the show includes live video from Levitz's audience and a makeshift editing style to properly emphasize the complete merging of disparate perspectives into a single composition. All the projects Joseph Gordon-Levitt features are unique enough to justify their inclusion, even if they don't all suit your expectations. Every episode is unpredictable and frantic, but all the while kept lovingly quaint by Levitt's adoration of fun. As someone typically focused on dark existential narratives, I was happy to observe, so much so I intend to participate in future hitrecord.org projects, open to anyone's creative contribution. Thank you once again for the show. I'm excited to hear your take on Master of None, as well as all future episodes. From JM in Vancouver. Hit Record. It's a show. I've never seen it. I know it's on Netflix now, but I think the reason it hasn't gotten a lot of attention, it's on a little network, right?
Pivot,
which is small upstart network. That's probably the reason it just hasn't gotten a lot of attention yet. But thank you, JM. I'm gonna have to check it out. It does sound intriguing. The fact that it is sort of crowdsourced is certainly the appealing part there.
All right. Well, one from your My List.
You mercifully gave me the low number of 7, and this time on my list, number 7 is Bushido Man, Seven Deadly Battles. The plot description is, Warrior Toramaru must adjust his fighting skills and later his eating regimen to defeat a series of martial arts masters in 7 epic deadly battles. And Allison, as far as I'm concerned, there's not nearly enough martial arts movies about eating regimens.
I mean, what does he...
I have no idea.
I'm just gonna eat all hard-boiled eggs and it will enable me to win in battle.
I have no idea. This is on here because Evan Sathoff, who is a writer on Birth Movies Death, tweets under the name @Sam_Strange, a friend of mine. We have similar tastes in these sorts of action movies, and he recently tweeted about the movie, watching it on Netflix. He liked it. And usually to me, if Evan tweets about an action movie and says he liked it, it's at least worth a look. So that is why I put it on my high list. So there it is. Bushido Man, Seven Deadly Battles and Eating Regimens. Allison, we don't have listener's choice options.
No, normally this is the part where we talk about the next episode.
Right.
But we are at an impasse here. Because the future is somewhat uncertain.
It's so appropriate that this is the 100th episode. It's almost like we're ending this big anniversary on a cliffhanger.
Matt Singer will be taking a little time off. He is about to become a dad, yeah. As he mentioned.
Not much, because we record bi-weekly, so it won't be too much.
But I will be here. I will be bringing in some guest hosts to fill in. But we decided that we wouldn't do the usual listener's choice votes this time because... didn't want to inflict that on guests who would be kind enough to just help us. So
when I've done guest hosts in the past, usually I let them at least help choose the movie. So it'll probably be a guest host choice review on the next episode, maybe the next two episodes.
Yes. So we'll give Matt some time to spend with his soon-to-be newborn child, and I will have some, I'm sure, hopefully very fun, interesting.
If you get who you want to get, it's going to be pretty awesome.
I think so.
No one's going to want me to come back.
Yes.
I will be banished permanently once these guest hosts show up.
Either way, I think that, you know, I'm sure everyone listening wishes you well.
Thank you.
In this new excursion into fatherhood.
Yes, I'm sure it'll be very
fun. I'm excited for you guys.
Yes, I'm sure the next time you hear me, I'll sound very exhausted, and it'll be very exciting. It'll be fun, and it'll give me a whole new perspective on these movies. I'll be talking about, I don't know, what do kids watch? Sesame Street, and I'll be recommending, like, Elmo's First Adventure or something.
You'll be like, all I've watched is Doc McStuffins for the past year.
So that's my recommendation. Read them and weep. Take it or leave it, buddy. Yeah, so it'll be fun. Oh, God. Well, until we speak to you again, make sure you're following us on Twitter at FilmSpottingSVU. We have no listener's choice to vote on right now, but make sure you're following us over there. FilmSpottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. Our remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can find more of Vince's work at VinceVandal.com. And Allison will be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review she and her guest pick, but... in the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore, at Matt Singer. And once again, the show's Twitter is at FilmSpottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice, although there isn't going to be one next time. And where we share lots of streaming suggestions from ourselves and from you guys, the SVU listeners. And hey, this is the 100th episode of FilmSpottingSVU. If you enjoy the show, if you have enjoyed the show, if you continue to enjoy the show, how about going over to iTunes, give us 5 stars, write a little review. It takes 5 minutes. Come on. Think of the hours, 100+ hours of entertainment we have given you. How many recommendations have we given you? We ask nothing, nothing, nada. Do this one thing for us. It's the 100th episode. Come on. Do it. Do it. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.